Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Alex Schumacher. It's warming up here in Minnesota. The days are getting longer, brighter, and warmer. Birds are returning to us after fleeing to the south, and love is in the air. On this episode of the podcast, we're taking a look at love in all of its strange and beautiful forms. We've got research, reptile, smash mouth, and more here on Real College Podcast. Everybody's heard the saying that the key to a healthy relationship is communication, communication, and communication. But as anybody who's been in a long-term relationship knows, communicating can be really hard sometimes. By studying couples trying and, well, sometimes failing to communicate properly, some researchers hope to build a more loving future. Nathan Fervoy has more.
There would be the video, and then I'd have a notebook, and then I would just write, like, some thoughts that I'd have about the people. Like, I'd be like, oh, this person seems avoidant, dot, dot, dot. And then
Far from what you might consider your typical unemotional and hard-to-relate-to scientific work, the research at the U.S. lab deals explicitly with some of the most personal and emotionally charged moments that a person can experience. Specifically, within the dynamics and conflicts of romantic relationships.
I also do see all the really gross stuff, too. Like, I see, you know, yelling and fighting and crying in a way that's, like, destructive sometimes. And, yeah, that also exists. But also there's, like, a kind of eye contact that's glazed, too.
Grace McCarthy is an undergrad psych student here at the U who, upon taking a student position at the lab, wound up with the awkward job of watching couples argue.
I would just go online. And then there would be, like, a million, like, files of couples, like, hundreds and hundreds. Yeah. And then I would go click on it, and then, like, in the full screen, you just see it would be split. So one half of the screen would be one person in the relationship, and then the other side would be the other person in the relationship.
And when I was sitting at a computer with a notebook at the ready, she would watch video after video of different couples, classifying each individual into the categories of either anxious or avoidant.
But the footage that I specifically watched was they were asked to resolve conflict resolution. They were asked to resolve the biggest, like, conflict in the relationship at that point, which could be basically anything from you don't, like, clean the dishes to, like, I'm moving to another country and I want you to come with me, or, you know, it can be anything, or cheating. So it's basically trying to, like, inflict a sort of, like, potential insecurity and see how they as a couple move around that and work through it.
Mm-hmm. But what's the purpose of dredging up a couple's private insecurities?
Right, so, like, this isn't, the science isn't urgent, you know, it's not going to cure a disease and it's not going to, like, immediately save the world, but it can really benefit dyadic and interpersonal relationships and the way that we go into them. And potentially this research can explain a lot of the reason why we are the way we are later in life based off of what we are earlier in life and that connection. And understanding that can help us be able to notice patterns in ourselves and then potentially be able to grow and break out of those negative patterns.
To understand the couple's research going on in this lab, we have to travel way, way back to the beginning. Before all of the heartbreak and trauma, to a time when the couple was just a couple of tiny, impressionable babies, just starting to make sense of the world around them.
Anxious and what is avoidant?
Yes, yes. So basically it's all based off of this one study. The study basically talked about a mother and her baby. Like, the study was, there would be, like, maybe this one-year-old or two-year-old would be in a room, and then the mother would start in the room and be holding the baby, and then the mother would leave for, like, 5 minutes, and then, like, the baby would just be alone in the room, and then the mother would come back, and then the baby would act in one of three ways. The first way is when the mother tried to hold the baby again, the baby would be super cold and distant. It's, like, stoic, non-expressive, like, away, distant from the situation. The opposite end of that is the baby would be excessively wanting the mother, super affectionate, super loving, like super needing that physical validation, or the baby would act the exact same way as the baby did before, which is basically stability. So applied to attachment, what that means is there's a spectrum of how we deal with insecure attachment, of when we deal with people that go away or like do us wrong. And so that's like how the basis of attachment theory is kind of formed. And then what is argued in the research that I've been doing is that same attachment theory that was demonstrated in that experiment. So they take that research and then they apply it to romantic relationships.
Essentially, the research tests the assumption that the attachment patterns established by a caretaker early in one's life carry forward into one's adulthood relationships.
And so what we're arguing is that, not necessarily as a baby, but like young formative years, you form these relationships with your parents. And if it's a secure attachment, you're going to be less likely to have an insecure attachment style with other relationships in the future. So if your parents, let's say, were very responsive, supportive, interactive in your life, stable, whatever that means to you, then later in life when you are pursuing romantic partners, the attachment theory argues that you'll look for a stable, responsive, you know, partner in the same way.
The ideal of stability in a relationship lies directly between the two poles of behavior, exactly half anxious and half avoidant. When a conflict inevitably brings uncertainty into a relationship, it's natural for a polarizing dynamic to occur in which one partner anxiously seeks resolution while the other holds out, avoiding uncertainty to maintain a simpler past state of mind. If the two partners are eventually able to close this divide through healthy communication, they can move forward. If not, the couple becomes stuck, each partner trapped at an unhealthy pole.
Let's say you had your parents or your guardian or your main caregiver, plural, growing up. If they made you feel insecure about your relationship with them, if it felt unstable, if they were gone all the time, or if they put you down, or if they did any of the ways to make you feel like you're not valued in the way that you should be, the theory states that that is going to turn into what you believe a relationship is. And then you're going to, later, when you get older, because you were trained that your first relationships were trained like, this is what I deserve, you go into your next relationships as you get older and you seek out those relationships.
If such division is present in a child's early development, then it becomes more than just an unresolved conflict. It might become a lifelong narrative set like cement in the foundational brain chemistry of a young person.
Right, yeah. So, like, how do you reach the point of a secure attachment again after, or maybe you were born with or grew up as an insecure attachment? That can look a lot of different ways. There's like no one way to getting to a secure attachment style, and it's definitely not a destination. I think it's like a practice, I would say. Everyone who feels insecure is going to act some type of way, I feel like, but like typically what is like recommended a lot is therapy, just because what's hard for a lot of people when they're in their insecure attachment style is be able to look outside of themselves and recognize that what they're feeling about the situation might not be what's actually going on or what actually might be happening. So a therapist can basically like work through what you're feeling about your relationships, as well as going back. Like, I think a lot of people already talk about it, right? Like, a lot of people are like, oh, this person's so like needy, they're texting me all the time and they're an annoying person. Or like on the opposite end, like this person's like petty and avoidant and won't open up about their feelings and blah blah blah, and like they're like a or something.
While in a way we all talk about these concepts and relationships today, what the Action Lab is trying to do by collecting data on relationships is create better words as tools for therapy. With luck, new language might be developed to assist those with ingrained unhealthy attachment styles in finding stability.
it's like, I think sometimes people kind of get a little bit weirded out by labels, and understandably so, because it can feel like it defines you. But as long as you use it as a stepping stone instead of like a destination, I think it's kind of productive, you know?
For Real College Podcast, I'm Nathan Fervoy.
And one time even someone proposed so like, it gets pretty crazy sometimes, but
spring, besides meaning warmth and longer days, also means it's mating season for other animals. Ben Hallam takes a look into the unique world of reptile breeding here in the Twin Cities and finds that there's more to it than what appears on the surface.
This particular story is one that I've wanted to do for a little bit of time while I've worked here on the podcast. You see, freshman year, one of my friends in the dorm invited me to join a Facebook group called Minneapolis Reptiles. I don't know how he got in the group or why he was in the group, but it was just something that was so interesting to me, to both of us, that it existed, that there was this community in Minneapolis and kind of around the world dedicated to the care and raising of reptiles, which were an animal that to me was something so foreign and so strange. But what wasn't foreign was the love that these people had for their animals. Like, I've had pets all my life. I know what it's like to have feelings of love and care towards an animal, and that was exactly the same. So in keeping with this week's episode theme of Love Is in the Air, I talked with Karsten Mikeworth, a reptile breeder and operator of Minneapolis Reptiles and ISO Psychos, to find out what it takes and what it means to love reptiles. And it turns out, cockroaches. Walking into the rooms where Karsten kept his reptiles and insects was like walking into a zoo. It was amazing. There were so many animals in tanks and tubs lining the walls of two whole rooms of his house. It was hard to believe that he had used to have a larger breeding operation. As we talked, Karsten took the time to show me some of his animals, including some of his favorite reptiles, his leopard geckos.
Okay. Wow. So that's a leopard gecko that just hatched today?
It is. Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, I really like leopard geckos. I mean, they're kind of a basic reptile. A lot of people have had them, but I work with a lot of high-end color mutations, and I just love their attitude. I tongue feed them stuff all the time, and they're very catty. They'll wag their little tail and look at you with their little cocked head, and it's just so adorable. And the carpet pythons I really like, too. They can be kind of rude sometimes. Some people don't like them. They're an acquired pet, but I always say just be the tree, and they're usually pretty calm.
Do you remember, like, the first reptile you ever had, or the first pet of that kind?
When I was a kid, my mom had a green anole, and his name was Mike. I was about 3 or 2, and then we also had a huge Pac-Man frog named Buddy. But once he got big enough to have to eat mice, my mom didn't really like having that pet anymore. And I would always let Mike the anole out because I was so curious. I'd wait till she was sleeping and go wrangle him out. He'd get out for a few days, and we'd find him laying in the sun.
And what's making that noise that we kind of keep hearing in here is that...
The chirping is actually dart frogs.
Dart frogs.
Yeah, we got dart frogs calling.
So they're just hanging out in here?
Yep.
After looking at the dart frogs, I asked Karsten how he moved from a love of reptiles to a business of reptile breeding.
When I was growing up, my mom only let me have, like, 3 or 4 pets at a time, so I always had to kind of sneak them in sometimes and try and hide them. And right when I turned 18, I moved in with an ex-girlfriend and decided, hey, I'm gonna buy a bunch of reptiles. And then it got expensive to feed, and of course I just wanted to fuel my habit essentially, and just keep the ball rolling, get new stuff, and keep everybody fed and happy.
And what have been some of your favorite things to work with over the years?
Definitely the roaches, weird enough. I mean, I got my first roaches to breed as feeders, and then I started seeing how cool some of the species were, and one species turned into five, and five turned into almost 30 now. And then same thing happened with the isopods. I bought my first ones to sell as, or to breed as feeders for my dart frogs, and now I have 58 different color morphs and species.
Yeah, check out the other room. And these are cockroaches?
Yep, these are rhino roaches. They're native to Africa, and this is actually the world's heaviest species of roach. And then I also have giant cave roaches, which are the world's longest species of roach. I can make a hiss or hiss for you, probably.
Okay, we could see about that. Just trying to ambient audio, too. These are, so there's just a lot, all these bins up here, are those all cockroach bins, yeah. Different types of cockroaches?
Yeah, I can show you some of the isopods, too, in the other room.
Show you these guys. Yeah, I guess keep thinking about that.
These are the world's longest species.
These are the world's longest species of roach. Oh my god. Those are really long. What would you say that you like especially about the roaches in particular, like breeding them? You talked a little bit about like different shapes and kind of things like that, but
yeah, I definitely think they're misunderstood. Like there's certain roaches that I wouldn't dare keep in my house in fear of an infestation, but most of these species I keep are tropical and they just come in so many different colors and they actually have little personalities, and if you hold fruit in there, they'll come up and eat it out of your hand and move their little antennas to talk. Like they're just an amazing creature.
And people use those to feed to their animals like snakes or things like that? Maybe not snake.
Yeah, it's more of like a collection. It's like live Pokemon cards. Like, I don't know, certain people are into them, certain people aren't, but I have maybe like five species that are primarily for feeders, but the majority of my collection at this point is just pure hobby and enjoyment.
Next, we checked out some of Karsten's isopods.
Yeah, I really like the isopods because they come in so many different colors. It's amazing, and there's always people finding new color mutations. That's one of my biggest dreams, to find an original one of something so I can start my own line, and it's so fun. You just get to collect and trade and sell, and like I said, it's just like Pokemon cards, but for a big kid.
I'd like to thank Karsten Mikeworth for showing me all of his reptiles and insects and providing me a window into this world, into which I've really only ever seen through Facebook. I started out wanting to do a story about reptile breeding because it was something strange and something I didn't understand. But as I was talking to Karsten, I realized that it's not that difficult to understand at all. It's the same kind of love and passion that anyone feels for anything that really interests them and speaks to them on some level. And with that, I'll leave you with Karsten Mikeworth.
A lot of them are just downright beautiful. And it's every single one's unique. I mean, they all have their own little personality. Even if you can't necessarily classify that all leopard geckos are going to be nice, just like you can't say all dogs are going to be nice. They're not the same. They all have their little personalities, and they all look different, and they're just so unique.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
Sometimes, try as hard as we might, love is just not in the air. And in those cases, a breakup happens. And while we often think of breakup stories as really drawn out and dramatic, Liv Riggins here brings you some low stakes, fun breakup stories.
Breakups are typically thought of as pretty dramatic, very emotionally involved, and upsetting, and a lot of times they are like that when they're for a serious relationship. But there's also a lot of times when they aren't dramatic, or they're just weird or absurd. I remember being in middle school and asking, air quotes, asking out a guy for a week through my friend Maddie, not talking to him the whole time, and breaking up with him at the end of the week, again through Maddie. Not dramatic, and not what you'd think of when you talk about a breakup story. So I asked around to see what other atypical, you know, undramatic or absurd first breakup stories were out there. So here's Ben with another undramatic breakup story, and then later Hannah with a story of how Smash Mouth destroyed her first relationship.
It's basically the story of how we started dating. She just kind of asked me out, and I was like, sure, which isn't very dramatic either. And we didn't really hang out that much during the summer, and then I was at scout camp, and we didn't have any, like, cell phone service while I was at scout camp because we were kind of, like, in the middle of nowhere, and I wasn't, like, using my phone because I couldn't charge it. And then I, like, turned it on at the end of it, and it was like, hey, Ben, I'm breaking up with you. Was just like a text message I got, and I was like, sure.
So I'm gonna call my ex Carl to protect the innocent. They're definitely not gonna listen to this podcast, but you know. Okay, so Smash Mouth was in town. And basically, I was super excited to go to Smash Mouth with my boyfriend. We were like planning this. This was a thing. We texted about it. And so I was like, okay, Carl, time to pick me up from the library, because I worked at the public library like all the cool kids do. And then I wait and I don't hear anything for 3 hours. And I'm there and it's like 10 p.m. and my boss is like, Hannah, are you gonna go home? And I'm just like, I thought I was gonna go do something. But I remember going home feeling very disappointed that I did not see Smash Mouth with my boyfriend. And then 24 hours later, I get a text, and it was like, sorry, babe, not feeling it. And I'm just like, well, you hurt my feelings. I thought you were gonna go to Smash Mouth. I get ghosted for a hot week. I'm just like, what happened here? And then, so I literally go to his house, and I'm like, what is going on? You're ghosting me for a week. He's like, we need to break up. You're too intense. And so I now blame Smash Mouth for my first breakup. Looking back on it, like, my mom went to the Smash Mouth concert with my aunt, and she's like, yeah, it was really weird. The Smash Mouth band was there. And I'm like, oh, I should have just gone and hung out with my mom. Smash Mouth destroyed my first relationship, but I will never hold that against them as a band, purely because they're just all-stars. They're just doing what they can.
What's the greatest love story ever told? Romeo and Juliet? Pride and Prejudice? No. No, it's none of those. Now, the greatest love story ever told could only be one that captures the true range of human emotions and asks tough questions like, how can I resist you? And if you live in the Twin Cities, you're in luck, because that great, true love story is being performed on a stage near you. Casey McCabe has more.
Even though it is well past Valentine's Day, here at Radio K, we like to keep love in the air year-round. In the spirit of love, the Chanhassen Dinner Theater has been putting on a production of Mamma Mia that runs until September 28th. With finals fast approaching, Hannah, Alex, and I made the pilgrimage to Chanhassen, Minnesota in an attempt to uplift our spirits. On the way, I asked Hannah and Alex what their opinions were on Mamma Mia.
I have seen the original Mamma Mia, well, the first Mamma Mia, many a time because my friends adore it. I have yet to see Mamma Mia 2, which is a scourge amongst my friends' film auteur lifestyles, unfortunately. But I do feel like Mamma Mia just makes a good musical because ABBA just has a good discography.
Thoughts on Mamma Mia in general. I saw the original movie a long time ago. I don't remember it at all. I have no memory of it. I just know Meryl Streep was in it and Colin Firth, and my mom likes it and my boyfriend likes it, but I have not seen it in a long time. But I have seen the second Mamma Mia. I did see that in theaters this summer when I was slightly tipsy because I did get a drink at the bar next to the theater, brought that in with me to Mamma Mia, and then ate chicken wings while watching the show. And I think that's probably, I guess that's why I'm really for the idea of Mamma Mia the musical being at a dinner theater, because I think, you know, drinking, eating food while ABBA's playing, that's like kind of the best way to experience ABBA and Mamma Mia.
Upon arriving at the dinner theater, we were greeted with the soft hum of music and the scent of food wafting across the parking lot. After spending a bit too much time loitering out front of the venue, I was approached by Chris Howland, the public relations director for the Chanhassen Dinner Theater. She was nice enough to sit down with me and explain how Mamma Mia and a fine dining experience collide on date night.
Well, of course, Mamma Mia is a great date night. I would say probably a good 20% are couples that come. And I would say a very high percentage are girls' night out because, you know, Mamma Mia is a very good mother-daughter sort of a thing.
Classic.
Yep. And then also we have a lot of groups. About 20% of our audience would be comprised of groups that come in busloads and things of that nature. And then we also have a lot of families, you know, grandmas, you know, parents, their children. It's a very great multi-generational sort of experience.
That's excellent. And then for those who are looking for a romantic night out, do you guys have, like, tables where it's, like, one-on-one, like, you offer different seating arrangements?
The main dinner theater seats about 600 guests. And most of the tables in that theater seat four, parties of four and parties of six. Okay. There are a few tables that are just for two. We call them deuces, and people do love them. Even though they're in the very front row and the very back row, people, they don't care. They want to reserve those. They go right away.
After seeing advertisements various places around campus and on buses, I was interested in how well Mamma Mia was being received. Chris says that the reception has been spectacular.
Every night is sold out of late because Mamma Mia has been such a spectacular hit for us. 60 million people around the world have seen this show, and so it's got a lot of fans. So we've been really, really, really busy with this show. So every night really has been sold out since it opened, and it's running through the end of September. And I would say tonight the house has sold out about almost 600 people. You know, we've been in existence for 50 years now. We've got a huge, great reputation in the industry. One of the things that sets us apart is the fact that we've never done a dinner theater where you eat and view the play at the same time. So the play is the thing, you know, we serve a delicious dinner, you come early, you sit down at your table, you have some wine, you have an hors d'oeuvre, you eat your dinner, which is a complete menu, lots of choices on the menu. Then you might want to order a dessert for intermission. And then once that show starts and the curtain goes up, it's all about the play.
Here we go again, reporting for Radio K's Real College Podcast. I'm Casey McCabe.
Well, that is all for this episode of Real College Podcast. Thanks to Nathan Fervoy, Ben Hallam, Liv Riggins, and Casey McCabe. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It was produced by Nathan Fervoy, Lizzie Ritchie, Ben Hallam, and Liv Riggins. Alex Schumacher is the host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks for listening.